A lawsuit related to Arizona's Medicaid expansion is still making its way through the legal system, and Governor Doug Ducey's administration is asking federal officials for some modifications. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, I'll talk with Tom Betlock, who heads the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, the state's Medicaid program. Plus, editorial cartoonists can generate a lot of responses from newspaper readers, and sometimes those responses are pretty negative. I'll talk with Steve Benson, Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist for the Arizona Republic, about where his ideas come from and what he thinks of reader reaction. Also, tomorrow night we'll bring the first nationally televised Republican presidential debate. I'll ask pollster Mike O'Neill what to expect. Thursday is also Jon Stewart's last night as host of The Daily Show, and O'Neill was one of Stewart's guests this week. We'll talk about it. And writer Tom Zellner believes Arizona doesn't have a great novel associated with it. Is he right? We'll consider the question. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
KJZZ is supported by Gardens at Ocotillo Senior Living, the newest Spectrum retirement community in Arizona, offering memory care living options focusing on person-centered care. More at gardensatocotilloseniorliving.com.
Look for sunshine today in the valley, high near 112 degrees. A few clouds tomorrow, the high dropping to 109, and a slight chance for some rain. We've got an excessive heat warning in effect until 8 o'clock tonight as well. Right now, under mostly sunny skies, it's 102 degrees in Phoenix at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, I'll talk with Steve Benson, Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist for the Arizona Republic, about where his ideas come from and what he thinks of reader reaction to some of his more controversial creations. Plus, tomorrow night we'll bring the first nationally televised Republican presidential debate. I'll ask pollster Mike O'Neill what to expect. Thursday is also Jon Stewart's last night as host of The Daily Show, and O'Neill was one of Stewart's guests this week. We'll talk about it. And writer Tom Zellner believes Arizona doesn't have a great novel associated with it. Is he right? We'll consider the question. We start today's program with the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System. Late last week, Governor Doug Ducey announced a program called Access Care. A news release says it will ensure choice, accountability, responsibility, and engagement. Eligible members would make contributions to an account similar to a health savings account that could be used for services not currently covered by Medicaid, including dental, vision, and weight loss, among other things. With me to talk about that and other Medicaid-related topics is Tom Betlock, Director of Access. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. So why is this proposal a good idea?
Well, I think it's a good idea because it's really the next step in the evolution of the Medicaid program. Medicaid is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. It's been around in Arizona for 33 years, but nationally it's been a program for 50 years. And when you look at how Medicaid has evolved over the years, it started with a program that provided coverage for children and pregnant women and the elderly, and has grown to cover individuals with disabilities, increased income limits, and more recently has expanded to provide coverage to a lot more adults. And when you look at that evolution, Medicaid's done a good job of creating systems and programs to reduce low birth weight babies, to improve overall performance as it relates to the populations that we've served. We've created home and community-based services for the elderly instead of individuals having to go into nursing facilities. And really, the adult population is a relatively new population for Medicaid, and I think the governor's program is right on in that it wants to engage this new coverage group in looking at opportunities in terms of building better health, better knowledge of the insurance market. I think we all know that insurance is complex and having a better understanding of that. And then also building in some incentives for work as well. And so I think the timing is right given the population that's served and how Medicaid has evolved over the years, not only in Arizona but nationally.
And Tom, what's the time frame for putting this to work? When will federal officials consider it? Any idea whether they'll like the plan or not?
Yeah, great question. And so Arizona's operated what's known as a waiver since the inception of the program. And the waiver is really a contract that we have with the federal government that provides us with some flexibility to really operate and do some of the things that we want to do as a state, whether that's using managed care or offering certain benefits and services. And so we are entering into the last year of our current waiver. It's set to expire October 1st of 2016, and we'll be submitting this formal proposal to the federal government on October 1st of 2015. Now, states have more recently proposed some things that are similar, and there's some things in this package that are new. And we've seen CMS, the federal oversight agency that we work with, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, provide some of these similar types of flexibilities that we've asked for. Not everything that's in the package, but say Indiana recently received the authority to establish health savings account. Michigan put some incentives in place as part of their 1115. And so we've seen instances where CMS has granted authority like this.
Tom, there are critics who see sort of any changes like this as an unfair approach in a sense, because we're talking about, yes, able-bodied adults. Are there protections in place for people who are working, actually have jobs, but the jobs simply don't pay enough?
There are protections from the sense of when you look at the population that's impacted, that's going to be participating in this program. If somebody is medically frail, they don't have to participate. If you have an individual with serious mental illness, there are exemptions for tribal members. There's also going to be an exemption as part of the proposal that would exempt the single adult of a household with children. And so we're looking at that as part of the overall balance for the program moving forward. Another important step is that as part of the waiver process, we will have public forums over the next several weeks. If you look at our website, there's several scheduled throughout the state. And so we welcome public input on this proposal and the overall waiver itself.
From a philosophical standpoint, Tom, you've been in this job for a while, and I presume there must be challenges because I presume you're trying to balance what it takes as far as empathy for people in the situation they find themselves in, but at the same time, there are major budget questions. Have you found that a challenge to find that balance?
Yeah, I think that's a balance that plays out every day in the Medicaid system. I think one of the overarching challenges of a program that in total spends almost $12 billion and provides coverage to 1.75 million Arizonans is the whole issue around sustainability. Medicaid's an important program, but at the end of the day, it's also supposed to be a safety net program. And I think part of what we're looking for here is, you know, we're serving a new population nationally in terms of adults. And what can Medicaid be doing to partner with other programs to look at opportunities? You know, I had the pleasure of going up north and speaking to a provider group recently. And after the discussion, I was on my way to the car and I had an individual come up to me and pulled out his wallet and showed me his Access card. And he said that Access saved his life. The services that he was able to receive in working with the provider saved his life and how grateful he was for that. But now he's fully employed, doesn't need his Access services anymore, but carries that card as a reminder. And we took a selfie to celebrate. But I think the dynamics that you describe in terms of the challenges faced by Medicaid are something that's felt by all states moving forward.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A couple of more minutes left with Tom Betlock. He's the director of Access. Tom, I'm guessing we don't want to get real deep into the legal questions because that's not part of your job, but how closely do you have to pay attention right now to whether the Medicaid expansion stays in effect, whether the courts overturn it? What's the potential impact of that decision?
Well, the potential impact is dramatic. And so just a quick summary for those that aren't fully engaged in these issues. Back in 2013, the state made the decision to move forward with restoring coverage for adults in the program. We, as part of that, had a state cost. Part of the legislative package was to include a hospital assessment, and right now that's being challenged by some legislators in terms of whether or not that required a two-thirds vote. The funding source, the hospital assessment, provides coverage for when you look at the restoration and expansion for close to 400,000 individuals. And so obviously that would have a significant impact not only on the Access program, but on the healthcare delivery system in the state of Arizona that all of us enjoy and its overall viability. People will still continue to get sick, and if they don't have coverage, they'll show up at the most expensive place to receive those services. And so we're following very closely in terms of the ongoing litigation. We just had a hearing recently. And ultimately, it'll be going before the state Supreme Court sometime in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Rural health care, also a big concern, Tom. And the a rural hospital, the only one in Douglas, closed its doors, and primarily because of concerns from CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. What kind of pressure could that put on people on access who live near Douglas? What kind of pressure could that put on the system if we see more rural closings like that?
Well, I want to commend the legislature and policymakers and the governor's office. Some more funding was put in to help provide additional resources for rural small rural hospitals in our state. Obviously, in a state that is diverse and large as Arizona, we've got a lot of important providers that serve rural areas of the state. And I think not only is it an important question, but really the future of the rural hospital is something that I think many states are grappling with, because you don't get the economies of scale that some of the urban hospitals are able to achieve, and you may not get the payer mix in terms of having commercial providers making as much in terms of payments to rural hospitals. So I think it's something that will be an ongoing dialogue that will occur not only in Arizona, but many other western states that have significant rural populations that need to get served.
And Tom, finally, when we started the conversation, we talked about the proposed changes that Governor Ducey has brought up. Access has been a highly regarded system since it was created, one that's been praised around the country. With the pressures of the recent recession then leading to budget cuts, more people, in fact, needing services, is access still a great model?
I think the access model is a great model, and I'm the president of the National Association of Medicaid Directors. I get a lot of chance to talk to my peers in other states, and you've seen a general movement nationally of states wanting to emulate managed care, because you're really leveraging the private sector. You're leveraging competition. You're leveraging choice in the marketplace. And I think all of those are good things. So while we may view access and Medicaid as a public program, in Arizona, to the greatest extent possible, we've really tried to leverage some of the private sector dynamics, and you're seeing that play out in a number of different states. So I believe that, yes, access is still a gold standard that other states are trying to emulate.
Tom Betlock is director of the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System. Tom, thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll talk with Arizona Republic editorial cartoonist and Pulitzer Prize winner Steve Benson. And then later on this hour, we'll preview Thursday night's Republican presidential debate with Mike O'Neill. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by El Encanto, providing the sights, sounds, and taste of Mexico for 25 years with restaurants in Cave Creek, Desert Hills, and Fountain Hills, lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch, weddings, and large events. ElEncantoRestaurants.com.
This is Here and Now on KJZZ. Stay with us today at 1 for BBC NewsHour. Checking Valley traffic right now on the eastbound Loop 202 Red Mountain Freeway. The shoulder is blocked by a collision at Mesa Drive. Westbound on the Loop 202, watch out for a disabled vehicle in the right lane at 32nd Street. Around the state right now, sunshine and 81 degrees in Flagstaff. It's 89 in Prescott, sunny and 100 in Casa Grande. Tucson reporting sunny skies, 98 degrees. It's mostly sunny and 102 in Yuma. A special thank you to our Leadership Society members, Jessica Jones and Richard Taylor, for their generous support in bringing programs like Here and Now and All Things Considered to KJZZ. To learn more about the Leadership Society, call 480-774-8257. Right now in Phoenix, under mostly sunny skies, we have 14% relative humidity, and it's 102 degrees at 1119.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. The life of an editorial cartoonist seems complicated. Your creativity is reflected in all of your work, both from the standpoint of what you've chosen as your topic and how you've drawn it. And you probably get the most angry letters to the editor when readers call you the worst things they can think of, while alternately accusing you of being a terrible liberal or a horrible conservative or an overall evil person. It's against that backdrop that Pulitzer Prize-winning editorial cartoonist Steve Benson does his work for the Arizona Republic. Benson started at the Republic in 1980, left for a while, and returned in 1991. And Steve Benson joins me now. Mr. Benson, good morning.
Hi, Steve. It's one evil Steve speaking to the other. This is horrible.
We're in good company. That's great. So, Steve, when you think about this, is the world your canvas? Can you do a cartoon about whatever you want?
Yeah, there's really no limit on the topics I can choose. I have free rein every day to come in and pick through the news. And I usually prepare myself. In fact, I always prepare myself before coming in and as I come in by reading, by going to the net, by watching TV, listening to the radio. So I have a pretty good sense of the breaking news and what people are talking about. So that'll be relevant to them when they see my cartoon and start calling me all kinds of naughty names.
Did it take you a while to get used to hearing those naughty names?
It takes a while. You know, it's but you get used to it over time, and it's actually kind of a barometer in a good way for what kind of attention you're getting from readers and what kind of, you know, hot buttons you're pushing. Because, you know, as one of my colleagues said, an editorial cartoonist throws the first punch in a bar fight, then stands back and watches everybody else join in. And if if we don't get a rumble going, then the cartoonist has failed in his job. I mean, you know, we get the threats, we get canceled. I had a woman out in Sun City call me once. She was so upset. She said, "I'm going to cancel my prescription." I said, "Don't do that, please." Seriously.
So the dreaded editors, do they respond to when you get these sorts of complaints? Are you backed, Steve?
Yeah, I am backed because there's no cartoon that goes in the paper without the editor first to seeing it and giving his okay to it. That doesn't mean he tells me what to draw. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he will give suggestions on what I should not draw. and he ultimately has oversight and final decision making on what constitutes good and or bad taste. So he is the ultimate arbiter, but he doesn't say, "Do a cartoon on this. You've got to draw it this way." I used to think when I was just a young buck that if an editor, you know, killed my cartoon idea, it was like shooting all the lights out in the universe and it would be dark forever. Mm. But what I try to do is come back with the same idea disguised in different trappings so he won't get it.
Do you have any preference whether it's a local issue or a national issue? Because it seems like at times the local issues can kind of dry up. I mean, they aren't quite as sexy as it was back in the mid-'80s, for example, when you were drawing Governor Evan Meekum.
That's right. I mean, that was the heyday. I mean, I got a call. I kid you not. I got a call one night from Evan Meekum. I had called him back, and he wasn't home, so he called me back, and he was in bed. Evan Meekum was in bed, and he turned to his wife and said, "Flo, roll over and go to sleep. I need to talk to this young man. I'm afraid his eternal salvation is at stake." And that is the level of discourse I had with a soon-to-be-impeached governor. But those were halcyon days. I mean, I just really loved them. And you're right. They can kind of get lost in the tsunami of breaking national news events about which most everybody, relatively speaking, know a lot more than they do about local issues if they're really, you know, paying attention to the big news. So I try to do at least one local cartoon, sometimes more, a week, just to keep my, you know, feet in the tar pits of Arizona politics.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with the Arizona Republic editorial cartoonist Steve Benson. So, Steve, as we mentioned, you started in 1980 when you were, well, I guess about 10 years old probably at that point.
Right.
So I'm wondering, when you started, have you changed? Has your style changed? Are you less forgiving, more forgiving?
Well, I've always felt what's remained consistent in my work, I hope, is that at the core of my cartoon is a message. An editorial cartoon is not designed just to as comic relief. It's designed to use various tools, satire, hyperbole, irony, humor, to make its point. But it ultimately should just use those tools like you would put food on a cafeteria plate. It's not the plate that's important. It's the food that's on it, and the food is the message. So I've always tried to maintain a consistency in having something to say every day that, you know, can add to the conversation and can help me join as a legitimate participant in the Rumble. My style has changed over time, but that's a natural evolution that all artists go through. I mean, I'm not comparing myself to Vincent van Gogh, but he used to look like a Rembrandt in his early 20s. He mastered the styles of the masters of his day, but then he branched off once he got his feet, on the ground into his own style. So I can look back on my work and see how I've changed over time. I've seen times where I was kind of in the doldrums a bit stylistically, and other times when I was snapping into new approaches, different ways of throwing ink around, using brushes, different tools, that kind of thing. And so that is a constantly vibrant and changing aspect of editorial cartooning. And if you're in it long enough, your style is always being subject to change, to influence from others by different experimentations. You do that kind of thing.
When it comes to the themes and the topics, I mean, there's this argument that a lot of people, they want to know what's going on in the world or politics, but they don't really take the time, so they're looking for kind of bumper sticker sort of ideas.
Right.
With what you do, can you, in that nice size square, do the same thing where you have a really quick, easily understandable message, but then there's also that underlying theme?
Yeah, you know, there have been studies done scientifically on why people react so viscerally and so quickly to visual images. And it's part of our evolved nature. When we all lived down the Serengeti Plain and we saw something off in the distance, a shadowy figure that scared us, we could survive by either killing it or running from it. And that's what we do when we see these visual images in editorial cartoons. They either want to kill the cartoonist or they want to run from him. But it is a very basic instinctual reaction that is paralleled by nothing else in the world of journalism. Now, when I say journalism, I'm not a reporter. I give my views on the news, but I don't write the news. And I have about 7 seconds or less to get my idea across in a way that resonates and is understood by the readers, whether they agree with it or not. So that involves three basic aspects. One is the stage scene. You have to set the stage. That means what props are you going to use? What scene are you going to create? The second element is caricature. You have to draw figures, public figures, who are recognizable, who are exaggerated but still recognizable, who are cartoonish, and that people can instantly understand who it is. And then the third thing, and the most important thing, is the message. So all of those elements are blended together when I'm trying to come up with a message and the mode of delivery. And it takes me more time to come up with the mode of delivery in my head than it does to actually draw it. I used to have a picture of an orangutan in my office sucking on his thumb, and the caption was, "I wish there was a longer work for thinking and a shorter work for weeking, a shorter week for working." A bit of that. So,
Steve, you're still a go-to guy, as you mentioned. I mean, you have 7 seconds to make this impact,
right?
And a lot of people turn to you first. What do you hate to ask the legacy question, but what do you think of having the impact like that, of being in this corner of the paper where people are going to go, okay, am I going to be ticked off? Am I going to laugh? What am I going to do?
Well, you know, I don't want to sound goofy, but it's an honor to have that special corner. I mean, I had a special corner in grade school, and it's when I misbehaved, but this one is different than that. This is where people go on a daily basis, and so it gives me an opportunity to express my views every day, and I take it seriously and gratefully, and not wanting to be too dramatic, but editorial cartoonists have played a very important historical role in not only the preservation of this country, but in the creation of it. Benjamin Franklin was an editorial cartoonist. He had his own newspaper called the Pennsylvania Gazette. In 1754, during the French and Indian War, he drew a very famous cartoon that is used today as a metaphor, the segmented snake cut into different parts representing the colonies, and it said, "Join or die."
Yeah.
And that cartoon today is still remembered and still hearkened to by editorial cartoonists, and that cartoon was used as a battle flag and a rallying cry when the Revolutionary War came upon the colonists, and it helped rally them against the British. Paul Revere was also an editorial cartoonist.
Yeah.
So, and he used to spread leaflets around, the British are coming, and I'm ripping off another cartoonist and spreading his work around, which he was doing. But so, yeah, they do have an effect, and they do get the ball kicked down the field, and they get people engaged in, the great experiment in democracy that we call free speech.
So before we let you go, as you and I have gone down the, I find interesting, rabbit hole of philosophy, let's go back to sort of the more the crass aspect of things.
Sure.
We've got the first Republican presidential debate tomorrow. Any of these characters you're looking most forward to drawing?
Well, Donald Trump is obviously the Donald. He's by far the most flamboyantly interesting person to draw. I'm thinking about doing a cartoon kind of preempting the debate where you would show like a GOP airline flying through the sky, a commercial jet, and the pilots are saying, thank goodness we dodged Donald Trump. And he's coming up underneath it as a drone, ready to take him out. So, and then, you know, there's what? There's going to be 10 that made the cut. I think that this is going to be an interesting debate because I hear from the right-wingers all the time accusing the left, me, and others of determining, you know, what people get to see in the media. Well, Fox is going to determine what, you know, debate participants, you know, people are going to see tomorrow night. And I'm not so sure the right-wing is complaining about that. So it all depends on whose ox is being gored. But, yeah, that's what I do. And I try to, you know, I look at this daunting task of drawing 10 Republicans tomorrow. I have a hard enough time just drawing one. I mean, you know, I'll only push myself so far. But we'll see how it goes.
Arizona Republic editorial cartoonist Steve Benson. He is a Pulitzer Prize winner. Steve, thanks for taking some time with us.
Evil Steve the Two, thank you very much.
Take care, Steve. Listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. In a scene that was reminiscent of the Academy Awards or college basketball's March Madness bracketology, Fox News last night unveiled the top 10 Republican presidential candidates who were invited to take part in the first national debate of the 2016 campaign season. There were some mild surprises, like the inclusion of Ohio Governor John Kasich and the exclusion of former Senator Rick Santorum and former Texas Governor Rick Perry. So how significant is the first debate? What can we expect to happen? With me to talk about that and much more is pollster Mike O'Neill. He's also the host of The Think Tank on KTAR. Mike, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
So what are we looking for? Are we going to see more attacks on Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or both?
Well, you know, the most logical source for a frontal attack on Donald Trump has been removed from the debate. And he could have been included. And that person is Governor Rick Perry, who has most frontally attacked him. And interestingly, the decision to exclude him from the debate rested solely with one person who could have included him. That man is Roger Ailes. Mm. And the rationale is as follows. They said from the very beginning they're taking the top 10. They could have very easily said, if you take the numbers and you round them to whole digits, Rick Perry is well within the margin of error. We're going to include number 11. And because it was Rick Perry, I think that had the potential of changing the entire tenor of the debate because Rick Perry, first of all, has been the one candidate who's shown the most willingness to take on Donald Trump. And secondly, it would have been a strategic. I could see him. I would write the script for him. Uh-huh. If he were on the debate, I would say challenge Trump directly for a second, then turn to the rest of the assembled masses of debate participants and challenge somebody else to say, who else here has the nerve to challenge this guy? And watch him have to shuffle and make a decision about that. I look at those that are left, and I don't see any logical candidate to adopt that position. Mm. John Kasich, maybe he's the number 10 guy. Mm-hmm. It's not exactly been his style, but he's probably one of the people on the dais who probably have the most personal objection to Donald Trump. I mean, Kasich has been kind of he is a very conservative guy, but within his state, he has been an accommodator.
Yeah. When we look at the way the stage is going to be set up, Mike, this strikes me as well. It's almost like the Supreme Court when they take their photos. You've got the ones that have been there longest sort of in the middle, and we spread out from there. So you've got
the top guys are in the middle, mm-hmm. and then you got the guys on the edge are hoping that the picture frames them.
Right, makes them look even smaller.
And by the way, let's look at this is not a debate.
Right.
90 minutes, 10 people. They're all going in. They're going to get to make a brief stump speech. Then they're going to get maybe one question, maybe two, depending on how they run it, which they will probably evolve to another preset stump. You know, the most significant thing, I think, about this debate is about the people who are not there. They have been defined as the basically the they're in the loser debate.
Yeah.
I think those campaigns are going to almost instantly fizzle.
Wow.
And I think that is the power of this first. 17 was way too many, but you couldn't stop them. But, you know, what's the arbitrary point? 10 was an arbitrary number, but it sort of became the thing. You either make the big boy debate or you don't. I think we focus on the top 10. I don't see anybody breaking into that. We will have attrition from the 10, but I think as of tomorrow, I think there are 10 candidates viable.
Okay, now, and we're talking about August right now.
Yeah.
And the first primary, first caucus.
It's August of 2015.
Another 5 months to go.
Yes.
It seems absurd that it's going to happen, but I think you're right based on the positioning.
Well, the other thing you'll note in every year when you've got a lot of candidates, it gets down amazingly fast to what I've always, my observation is 2.5 candidates.
Right.
There's two candidates are viable, a third candidate who has a constituency, who has staying power, but will not win. That was, for example, Huckabee last time.
Right.
Okay. Or at Huckabee Santorum. They basically had the religious right constituency, not enough to win, but enough to not go away. So they were a factor, but they weren't going to win.
So I started off with the idea of Trump or Hillary. Is Hillary going to take a lot of blows tonight?
That will be the common refrain, and that's how they avoid blood on the floor. It will be a series of stump speeches talking about how bad Hillary is.
And at this point, considering it's going to be on Fox News, and considering the country is so divided as it is, what does this do to generate? You're talking about Hillary Clinton, who was Secretary of State. She was the First Lady. She was a U.S. Senator, and yet in a Republican presidential debate on a network that certainly leans right, does it do anybody any good to get? Does this just get the masses excited?
Oh, that's what this is about: rev up the troops.
Okay.
You know, and there's no downside to beating up on Hillary. I mean, the only downside is they did that in 08, and then she wasn't the nominee, and they had to do an up shuffle. No, Hillary is the worst thing under civilization. No, I mean Obama.
Right, just in terms.
And she's shown enough weakness that who knows, that could be the problem this time if they spend too much energy on her.
So as you mentioned, 90 minutes, 10 candidates. Are there any issues that will really be discussed? Are there certain issues that there will be true disagreement among the candidates, even if they don't go after each other?
I think the big enchilada and the real problem for the Republican Party is immigration.
Mm.
And it's how extreme do you go? Everybody's anti-illegal immigration, but it's sort of how punitive, how militarized, how far out on a limb. And Donald Trump has demonstrated that there is about 25% of the Republican constituency for whom there is no limit about how extreme you can go. There is no statement. So, I looked at this. I tell you, I don't get fooled very often about what I listen to a statement. What will the impact been? I was fooled when he went after McCain and said he's not a hero. I said, I think that's over the line. And I was wrong. The 25% that are, you know, sort of Trump core constituency, they're going with him to the ends of the earth. There's no statement too extreme that he could lose them.
Boy, it seems like Trump should move to Arizona, then run against McCain in the Senate primary, right? Get all those Maricopa County Republicans ready for him.
Yeah. And give the seat to a Democrat.
It's Here and Now in KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix with political analyst Mike O'Neill. We're talking primarily about tomorrow night's first Republican presidential debate, but you are also a celebrity because tomorrow night is the final Daily Show with host Jon Stewart. And somehow, now, Mike, I respect you. I've known you for a long time. You're one of his final guests. How did that happen?
Well, actually, that's not exactly true now as of last night.
Oh, okay.
I got an email. They pre-produced the segment, and they said, we just ran out of space. We will run you in the first week of the Daily Show without Jon Stewart in 6 weeks. I They didn't say it, but I got a pretty good idea what happened.
Okay.
It's the last week of the show. They got deluged by A-list celebrities who wanted to get on to say goodbye to Jon Stewart, and Mike O'Neill got bumped.
But give us an idea of the background. How did that connection, how was it made?
They called me.
Okay.
And I asked them what from. Actually, I knew a guy that used to write for The Daily Show. I said, is that why? They said no.
Okay.
We didn't. In fact, he hasn't been here for 2 years. So, and they said, internet search. We looked in your background. Extraordinary. These people are serious. You know, what you were just talking to Benson, I think they are cut from the same cloth. They are using comedy as a vehicle, but these are some of the most serious people I have ever met. And I will compare this to being interviewed by The Economist, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal. They did more prep. 2 or 3 hours on the phone, 1 hour, first conversation, 1 hour talking to him. They were basically picking my brain. What does this guy know?
Yeah.
And sort of I made the cut on that. And then a troop comes out to my office, 10 of them, okay? Wow. Video guys, sound guys, whatever. And I've been interviewed by network television, NBC News, 3 guys, okay?
Yeah.
Daily Show, 10 guys. They're out there for 4 hours. Al Madrigal sat down with me and interviewed me for 4 hours, okay?
Wow.
Now, I think I was brilliant and erudite for 3 hours and 58 minutes. I got a pretty good idea what's going on the show, okay? Now, they are, I'm saying, these people are using comedy as a vehicle, but they really are editorial cartoonists. They are cut from the Benson cloth. They have a point of view. They are not. They are serious about the news. They are not objective about the news. They have a point of view, hence the editorial side.
Mm-hmm.
These are very brilliant, knowledgeable people who do an incredible amount of, I mean, a 4 hour, and I'm just a slice of this story. Then they trucked out, I won't tell you the top, but yeah. they there was a lot others. They worked on this for weeks. Incredible man hours, production value, and to use a tiny slide. I mean, when I've done a network, and it's the ratio isn't a whole lot different from local. Network guy comes out, you talk to him for 15 minutes, and they'll use a 30 seconds, a minute, something like that. The other difference, though, is with The Daily Show, they'll ask you, they do what a lot of people think that news people do, but news people really don't. They'll ask the same question 6 different times till they get the answer they want, and then they'll use that. Because, I mean, they do come into it with a point of view. And people think by the way that you do that, and I know that you don't. You know, you go in and you want to know, you know, what do you think about this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I will tell you, and you'll run with whatever. You don't have a right answer on my part as long as it's literate.
Right.
They have an answer they want. You know, and they have a way of working it. They have a point of view. They threw some stuff at me. I don't want to give it away. We can talk about it. But they, I could tell where they wanted to go with it. And they were going to get a use of that no matter what. And then the funny thing at the end, Al, the comedian who's interviewing me, does about 18 double takes that they will splice in. You know, really? You know, eyebrow raised, whatever. Yeah. And does that over and over, and they'll go back in the edit room and they'll splice it in.
Pollster and political analyst Mike O'Neill. I was going to watch The Daily Show, especially for Mike. Now I have to set my DVR 6 weeks from now, you're telling me? But anyway, congratulations on being on, and thanks for the analysis as always, Mike.
Thanks.
Stay tuned. Still to come on Here and Now, does Arizona not really have a great novel associated with it? We'll talk with Tom Zellner coming up.
KJZZ is supported by APS Solutions for Business, helping small business owners by assessing energy use and making your business more energy efficient so you can manage your bottom line. Learn more at aps.com/betterbottomline.
Good morning. This is KJZZ's Here and Now on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. An excessive heat warning in effect again for the Valley today until 8 o'clock this evening. We're expecting a high near 112 degrees. It'll be partly cloudy tomorrow, a little bit cooler, the high just 109. Well, on the westbound Loop 202 freeway, a couple of situations to watch out for. At 32nd Street, there is a disabled vehicle, and Loop 202 westbound, the HOV lane where it connects to the I-10 westbound is closed by a crash. At 12, we'll have NPR's Here and Now. President Obama is defending the nuclear deal with Iran, which Congress will vote on next month. Also, the disappearance of one of the world's most famous free divers. Here and Now from Boston is coming up at noon. Right now in Phoenix, under mostly sunny skies, it's 102 degrees at 11:45.
You are listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Mississippi has the works of Faulkner. California has Steinbeck's novels and many others. Plus, there are other states that can point with pride to being the home of some of the greatest works of fiction in American history. But Tom Zellner, fifth-generation Arizonan and author of A Safeway in Arizona and Train, Riding the Rails That Created the Modern World, argues that Arizona doesn't have its own great American novel. He'll be leading a discussion on the topic next Tuesday night at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix. He joins me now from the studios of KNAU in Flagstaff. Tom, good morning.
Good to be with you.
So why does Arizona need this great novel you're talking about?
Nothing quite like a novel really explains a civilization to itself. And Arizona is, in fact, a civilization, a young civilization, but one that lacks kind of a defining narrative. And while there have been tremendously good novels that that have been set here, there really is no kind of literary paradigm. We're still immature in that way.
Does a novel like this have to have universal truths? Arizona is extremely diverse in many ways, so how hard is it to find that?
Well, that's the primary job of a novel, I think, that you've identified. It taps universals. It sort of causes the reader to sort of sit upright and say, my God, you know, how did this author know that I was thinking that or feeling that? And, you know, how did this author, you know, sort of explain this landscape in a way that is obvious, but yet somehow escapes us? And so I should say that that this panel and the discussion is sort of tied to this essay, which is coming out in the next edition of Phoenix New Times, which is sort of a review, as complete a review as I could manage, of all the novels that have been set here. All the novels of prominence, and asking the question of each of them, is this the great Arizona novel?
Tom, I don't want to start an argument here, but I was reading some of that list, and I was not overly excited by it. So I'm tending to be on your side on this one, but give us a couple that you think almost meet the grade.
Well, I would love it if you would start an argument, and in fact, that was the intention of this essay, was to sort of roll a hand grenade, if you like, into the living rooms of Arizona authors, and kind of throw down a challenge to write that great sweeping social narrative that our state just cries for. Listeners are all too familiar with sort of the ups and downs we've been through as a state in the last 20 years. And, you know, I don't think a novel is going to necessarily save Arizona, quote unquote, but I think it will hold a mirror up to us and show us sort of the interior and spiritual work that we need to do. But to your question,
yeah.
What are the candidates? There are several. Blood Meridian, written by Cormac McCarthy, of course, a non-Arizonan, sets 71 incredibly violent pages of that novel in southern Arizona. The 19th century, sort of almost the biker gang of the Glantons who went hunting scalps. Is that the great Arizona novel? For various reasons, I don't think so. A number of people always bring up The Monkey Wrench Gang by Edward Abbey. Mm. Half set in Utah, it should be pointed out, and of a particular time and place. It is an absolutely brilliant novel, one that I read in high school and that I've never forgotten. But does it really explain sort of the deeper malfunctions of Arizona? I'm not quite sure. I like a 1928 novel called The Laughing Boy, set on the Navajo Reservation, a doomed love story that is a tale of cultural collision. There's the entire corpus of Zane Grey, of course, the cowboy novels, the pulp dime, you know, oat operas that that defined Arizona literature for most of the first half of the 20th century, the lament of the vanishing West. You know, that's the theme.
But that does sort of leave the realm of what we're talking about, because when we think about that great American novel, it seems as though it has to be one that, as we said, really grabs people in deep ways, in multiple ways. And at the same time, there's a good point you make in the essay as well. In order to spread the word, you need to have these books taught in school. It needs to be really passed down to generations, and it seems like we're really lacking that as well.
Correct, yes. In order to sort of be crystallized in a collective mindset, the novel has to be taught. It has to be sort of part of a curricula. And it can't be too glitzy and too popular, but neither can it be, you know, so dense and theoretical that no one understands it. So it has to sort of thread that needle carefully. Like, for example, The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne or Moby Dick, you know, these novels that are not only well written, but also speak to higher registers of meaning.
Tom, what struck me, and I was thinking about, you make the reference to 1920s Mississippi and how the upheaval there is similar to maybe what Arizona has gone through recently, and this idea of having a person now write that great American novel. I think so much about the changes in the publishing industry and this idea that if the great American novel, it's almost like if the tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it, if the great American novel is written, but maybe it's self-published or 400 people read it, I guess I feel like, is it harder now to have that because you're so dependent on just a couple publishing houses or whatnot?
My view is the opposite. I'm an optimist. Okay. I think that it's never been a more felicitous time to be an author. And the hegemony of New York publishing, you know, the walls are coming down. It's easier and easier to, you know, get a great story out in front of people via ebooks, via the internet. This is actually kind of the golden age of the written word. And, you know, my fondest hope is that someone will read this essay or perhaps go to this panel at Changing Hands on August 11th. There's my subtle plug. And perhaps take up the challenge to write this novel and to tell the Arizona story in a vibrant way that we've not seen before.
Tom, have you, as I mentioned, you've written two highly regarded books, maybe more, forgive me, but the two that I mentioned with Train and A Safeway in Arizona. Have you wanted to be that great American novelist?
Oh, I've wanted, but I've failed. I don't feel that I have any talent for fiction. So this is my saying that somebody else should, you know, mow the lawn here.
I guess moving forward, too, are there certain elements that can a great Arizona novel be something that doesn't have Western themes? Can it be something that is set in the modern day?
That's a great question. I mean, part of what the genius of a novel is it sort of examines and, you know, sometimes tears down established narratives. And yes, you know, the experience of Arizona was a 19th century collision of cultures. It was ranching, it was labor disputes, it was Latino, indigenous, and Anglo mixing together, trading together, fighting, etc. That is sort of the Arizona story as the rest of the country understands it and as we understand it. But is that really, truly what's going on? And I think a novel could perhaps, you know, tear down some of those old narratives.
You know, there are some people who would argue that we don't really need this at this point. And I guess, Tom, last question for you is, we talked about it a little bit at the beginning, but what are your best 30-second arguments for why this will be good for Arizona to have a great novel associated with it?
Nothing quite like a made-up story, I think, can really penetrate to the soul and cause people to examine the way that they've been living. And just so, you know, sort of like the fish recognizing that it's swimming in water, sort of the David Foster Wallace argument. Arizona's had some tremendously good nonfiction. We have, I think, as good an output as any in that genre. Fiction, we have a long way to go.
Tom Zellner, fifth-generation Arizonan, author of A Safeway in Arizona and Train, Riding the Rails That Created the Modern World. He's going to be Tuesday night at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix, leading a discussion on the topic of whether Arizona needs a great American novel. He joined us from the studios of KNAU. Tom, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. While it may be in the triple digits for the foreseeable future, in the world of pop culture, summer is winding down. Here to talk with me about some of the season's highlights and what to look forward to coming up is KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Steve.
Let's start with movies, because summer is the time for blockbusters, action movies. One that caught my eye for sure is the newest Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation. And it's because Tom Cruise is not a young man anymore, and yet he still performs his own stunts in his 50s. This is his fifth Mission Impossible movie, and he's still a seriously bankable star. Now we're starting to see more action movies that take the traditional framework and twist them around a bit, and sometimes by putting women in the lead. Do you think we could see a woman as the lead in a similar franchise of action movies?
Well, I really hope so. I mean, it's hard to say. The person that stands out the most to me is Melissa McCarthy, and she was, of course, most recently in Spy, which is an action movie, but it's also a comedy. She was also in The Heat, a buddy cop comedy with Sandra Bullock. She's going to be also in the new Ghostbusters. The thing about all of those movies, though, is that because of the nature and kind of the tone of the movies, I don't think people always see her in the same realm as, like, James Bond or Ethan Hunt. Like, her characters are not presented quite as smooth or suave or polished as those characters, but so much of the structure of action movies is dependent on these really traditional gender roles. So I do think it's possible that kind of as we slowly begin to see more women taking the lead in those movies, there's a chance that the structure and the expectations of those characters could change a little bit.
And summer is also a new TV season, which, Sarah, when I was a kid, it was not the case. It was always like this very structured season. It seems like this year more than ever, we've been hearing about shows on the streaming services like Netflix.
Definitely. I mean, Orange is the New Black was probably the most anticipated streaming show of the summer, possibly the most anticipated show of the summer at all. And most people like binge watched it in less than a week when it came out in June. And then last week, Netflix released the show Wet Hot American Summer, which is a prequel to the 2001 movie. So now, if you haven't seen the movie, you are not alone. It did not do well at the box office. Most critics didn't see any value in it at the time, but it stars almost everyone funny. It's got Amy Poehler, Paul Rudd, Molly Shannon, Bradley Cooper, Janine Garofalo, just a ton of people. And it became a cult classic. So the movie takes place over the course of the last day of summer camp at a camp in Maine in 1981. And the 8-episode prequel takes place over the first day of camp that same summer. So it's amazing and hysterical, and I have enjoyed binge-watching it myself. So here's a clip from it when Paul Rudd comes crashing in to the counselor orientation on a motorcycle.
I'm late.
Andy, so nice of you to grace us with your presence. You were supposed to be here a week ago.
Whatever. Smells weird. Who beefed? Nice lady shorts, McKinley.
Yeah, I got them from your mom's dresser. Oh!
Good one. Hey, man, don't make fun of the guy who dresses my mom.
Oh, I'm sorry, man. I didn't realize you. I thought your mom was still dressing herself.
Okay.
And, sir, we have to mention, too, you mentioned it was a prequel. And these are actors who are now, like, well into their 40s playing, supposed to be playing, what, 20-year-olds?
Supposed to be playing 16 and 17-year-olds. It's fantastic. I highly, highly recommend it.
There's also been a lot of talk about some reality TV shows that were on cable, especially I Am Jazz on TLC and I Am Kate on E! These are two shows about trans women. Jazz is 14, became famous for coming out publicly as trans at a very young age, and for her activism around LGBTQ issues. And Kate is Caitlyn Jenner. Let's take a listen to a clip from each of these shows. We'll hear from I Am Kate first.
Jenny, come on, let's get in the hot tub. I don't think I'm ready for that. You have to realize these girls transitioned years and years and years ago. I just don't know if I'm ready to expose myself like that. Maybe down the line I'll feel more comfortable with myself. But right now, I just can't see myself doing it.
And this is from I Am Jazz. Jazz is talking to her mother about going out with some friends.
I told you about bowling, right?
Not really.
Well, basically, a few of my friends are coming that you already know.
Uh-huh.
And then we're also trying to invite some boys.
What? Have you girls had any luck getting the boys to come?
We've invited a bunch, but, like, I know the girls that are coming, but I don't even know what boys are coming.
I think the reason that Jazz doesn't like hanging out with boys is because the boys aren't nice to her. They don't acknowledge her presence. They hug all her friends and then ignore her. And she says it doesn't bother her, but I think deep down inside it gets to her. How could it not?
Sarah, do you think because these shows are in the format of reality TV that even though they're trying to tackle difficult personal subjects, people may not take them as seriously?
I think probably more in the case of Caitlyn Jenner. People have seen her on reality TV for a long time, and because Keeping Up with the Kardashians is a show that a lot of people don't respect or take very seriously, I think that folks are feeling done with that franchise and done with everyone on it. But it's interesting because it still gets watched by a lot of people, and in the second week of I Am Kate, half of the audience dropped, which is huge. And that could be for a number of reasons. I mean, it could be because the initial reaction to her coming out is starting to wear off, or it could be just because the show isn't as interesting as they thought. I think the thing that may make it tough for people to take I Am Jazz seriously is that it's on TLC. And TLC does not have a great track record in terms of respecting its subjects. But generally speaking, I think for a lot of people, particularly people who identify as cisgender and don't know anyone who identifies openly as trans, this is a way to see into the lives of two trans individuals. And we're still filtering reality TV in some ways because we know that a lot of situations are set up, but they're still talking about things that these women are actually thinking about, like wearing a bathing suit in public and why that's difficult, or negotiating dating.
Okay, Sarah, lastly, the MTV Video Music Awards are coming up, also known as the VMAs by some of us, coming up on August 30th. Now, tell me a little bit about their significance and what to expect from them this year.
Well, the thing the VMAs are most known for is their outrageousness. This is the event where Kanye West famously interrupted Taylor Swift's acceptance speech. Think about the Oscars and the pageantry of the red carpet. It's all about who you're wearing and, you know, looking as classy as you can. And the VMAs are about just looking as outrageous as you can, wearing something crazy, most wild outfit, or maybe the most talked about performance of the year, doing something really daring on stage. And this year, Miley Cyrus is hosting. And of course, she's famous for being as over the top as possible. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of this year, because maybe Miley will do something even crazier than last time. Or maybe she'll step out of the spotlight a little bit to, you know, as the host, to kind of let other performers shine, which is probably unlikely, but we'll see what happens.
KJZZ, Sarah Ventry, catching us up on pop culture. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
And Sarah's also our senior producer. Thanks for her help on today's program. Also, thanks to Bruce Drummond, and thank you very much for listening. If you missed any part of the program, you can catch us online later this afternoon at kjzz.org. You can also download the KJZZ app to your smartphone. If you want to hear any of our conversations with Mike O'Neill or Tom Zellner or Tom Betlock of Access, you can find those online later today. NPR's Here and Now is next on member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Steve Goldstein. Hope you have a great afternoon. It's 12 o'clock.